Every month, several dozen strangers gather in a New York City apartment for an event called Chaos Cooking. Now, let me be clear. We're talking about upwards of 40 people in one apartment, one New York apartment, and almost all of them cook a dish to share. Here's the real catch to Chaos Cooking, and it's a big one. It's all done with a single stove. John Kalish dropped by and brought back this report.
Chaos Cooking takes place in an apartment in the Bushwick section of Brooklyn, an inner-city neighborhood that has become a magnet for young hipsters in recent years. The modest kitchen is so crowded and zooey, I can't get very close to the stove. I wasn't the only one struggling to get near those burners. Ryan Ong made something he learned to cook during a visit to Thailand.
I made pad thai. It's a lot of preparation. When you cook it, it takes about 15 minutes, not even. Preparation takes about a half hour.
Was it tough to get some time on the burner in the kitchen?
Very. It is very difficult to get time on the burner. But, you know, I've been waiting the entire time, and you just got to shove yourself in there. It's like sports.
Some veterans of these chaos cooking events have decided that it's just easier to make something that doesn't need heat to complete. The big beefy guy making minted honeydew soup in a blender is a diamond salesman named Mike Freed.
There's a lot of pressure you have to figure out in terms of time. I mean, when you're cooking in your own apartment, you just want to make a soup, you make a soup. But I wanted to make a soup, and hey, I'm probably not going to be able to get a burner for an hour, so I should make cold soup. And that's where you come up with ideas. So it causes you to be more creative.
Freed served his cold honeydew soup in plastic cocktail cups, prompting one woman to suggest he add some rum. The apartment where Chaos Cooking takes place is occupied by a guy known as Joe Che.
A lot of us in New York are astray from our families. We don't have them close. We don't get those holidays all the time like we used to. Everyone's clamoring in the kitchen and you're sweating and there's 30 things in the oven and burners and people are bouncing off each other and it kind of reminds you of home.
Che's living room has several tables set up for food prep. At one, David Leventhal is making Indonesian beef satay.
We're very interested in a concept called participatory culture, where everyone is involved, no one's a spectator.
That's an idea that most of these 20 and 30-somethings are down with. Furniture designer Jesse Mann was cutting up jicama and papaya for a salad.
Cooking with people builds community in a way that nothing else can. I think what you're seeing here is community forming before your eyes.
We're making the great stuff.
As with any community, this one has all sorts. A fellow who was researching the slow food movement stood making a spinach and strawberry salad for 2 hours. When he mentioned that he had a secret sauce and that he used to be one of those dumpster-diving freegans, I declined a sample. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in New York.
To the Gulf of Mexico now, where BP successfully cut a bent riser pipe earlier today, part of the company's latest effort to contain the 6-week-old spill. The next step is to lower a containment cap over the leak, though it's unclear just how much of the oil that would capture. Also unclear is what can or should be done about the hundreds of thousands of barrels that have already fouled the Gulf waters. Much of that oil has begun washing ashore in the form of tar balls, but last month at least 3 groups of researchers reported evidence that some of the oil remains deep under the surface in huge undersea plumes. One of those researchers joins us now. Professor Samantha Joy is a marine scientist at the University of Georgia. Professor Joy has been working on a research vessel, the Walton Smith, in the Gulf, and she joins us now on the water. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And first, how would you describe what these plumes are?
Well, basically, these are deep water features that we see starting at about 200 meters above the bottom, around 1,300 meters water depth, and they're most intense near the spill site, and they decrease in intensity away from the spill site.
Now, last week, the CEO of BP, Tony Hayward, dismissed reports of plumes. This is what he said.
There's no evidence of oil has a specific gravity that's about half that of water. It's very difficult for oil to stay in the column. It right. wants to go to the surface because of the difference in specific gravity.
He's appealing to our memories of middle school science here, saying the oil is lighter. It shouldn't be in plumes under the surface. It would naturally be on the surface.
Well, that's true. If you were to take a bottle of oil and release it from a few meters below the surface, a blob of oil, it would float up to the surface. But we're not doing that. What we're doing is we're taking a highly pressurized solution and we're exploding it out of the seafloor under high pressure and high velocity. So it's much like putting olive oil in a bottle and then pressurizing it and then spraying it out in an aerosol form.
Now, do these deep water plumes pose any different or any greater environmental threat than, say, the tarballs that have been coming ashore?
Well, it's a much different animal because there really is no way to clean these deep water features up. You can't burn it off. You can't take it off with a skimmer ship. It's not going to wash ashore where you can clean it up off a beach. So these features are likely to persist in the water for a lot longer and be much more difficult to remediate in the natural processes, natural microbiological processes. So those are the things that are going to take care of the deep water system.
Have you or any of the other researchers been able to actually capture a piece of this plume somewhere and analyze it, or are you making these judgments based on sonar or other means?
Well, we actually have a cassette of bottles called Niskin samplers, and we lower this cassette of bottles. Then we trigger the bottles and collect water from those specific depths. And when we do that near the spill site, the water that we retrieve from these plumes smells oily. It has visible oil in it. It has an incredibly high concentration of methane gas, and we have samples that are oily. You can see the oil in the water.
You've described how deep these plumes would be. How long are they actually? How many miles might a plume stretch from the site of the well off to the east, say?
We're still getting weak to moderate signals as far as 24 kilometers from the spill site. The plume spreads out a lot more as you get far away from it. And when you get more than about 3 miles from the leak, you can no longer smell oil in the water.
Well, Samantha Joy, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
Professor Samantha Joy is a marine scientist at the University of Georgia. She spoke to us from her research vessel in the Gulf of Mexico. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Mohammed El-Erian is probably one of the most important people you've never heard of. He controls more than $1 trillion in investments. He predicted the danger of subprime mortgages long before the market collapsed. He did the same for Greek bonds. In short, he's one of a handful of people who determines how the financial world thinks about the future. El-Erian spoke with Adam Davidson of our Planet Money team about his vision for the next 30 years.
If for some reason you want to find out if someone watches way too much CNBC or one of those other financial TV networks, just ask them what they think about the new normal. The new normal. Those guys on the money shows, sometimes it's all they talk about.
Now the new normal from the trading floors.
Part of the new normal for investors is...
Now we think we're doing about 4, and that is a new normal.
Evan and Manal are the faces of the new normal in the American workplace.
What the folks at PIMCO call the new normal.
What Mohammed said about the new normal.
We keep hearing about the new normal.
Yeah, what is that?
What is that indeed? What is the new normal, and why is everyone talking about it? The new normal is Mohammed El-Erian's idea. He's the CEO of the major bond fund, PIMCO, based in Newport Beach, California. Now, the financial shows, they only care about how El Arian's new normal impacts your bottom line. And yes, part of his prediction is that stocks and bonds won't do that well for many years. But when I sat down with him, El Arian explained that the idea is much bigger than finance. It is a view about the very structure of the world economic and political system.
The world of yesterday was a world of tidy categories. On the one hand, you had industrial countries, advanced economies. On the other hand, you had emerging economies. The first were at the core of the system. They held the system together. The second, emerging economies, were at the periphery and tended to be crisis prone.
Think back 12 years ago. There was a major global economic crisis started in Indonesia, Taiwan, Brazil, Russia. Or 1994, when Mexico was in financial crisis. Or Argentina had that economic crisis in 1982 and in 1989 and 1994 and 2001. You know the basics. A relatively poor country gets in a lot of financial trouble. And the grown-ups, the U.S., the U.K., the World Bank, the IMF, show up and sort everything out. That sounds almost silly to say now, huh? Back then, those olden days that existed up until 2 years ago, the world economy was governed by the regular meetings of the G7, the seven richest countries in the world. Sometimes they'd let someone else show up.
At best, countries like China would be invited to a breakfast, but not really be part of the formal discussions.
In other words, Italy and Canada had much more influence over the global economy than China and India, right up until 2 years ago when China stabilized the world economy after the U.S. sent it into disaster. So, the new normal world is one in which the U.S., Japan, Germany have less influence. Not none. They'll still be major players, just not the exclusive major players. China, India, Brazil, many of the more successful emerging economies will have a lot more influence. Now, I just used emerging economies, and El Arian would say that that language of developed and developing countries, of industrial and emerging economies, that language is over with.
Lots of shorthand that we used in the past has to be changed. And that's what a paradigm shift does. That's what a regime change does. You have to go back and look at all the shorthand that you use, all the mindsets, and change. And let me tell you, Adam, that is very difficult.
Look at Greece. They are technically an industrial developed economy. Same with Spain and Portugal. But they are clearly much riskier than countries that are still technically classified as emerging, developing. This is a power shift that will play out in politics, economics, culture, and possibly in armed conflict. It is not easy for long-standing order to be overturned by new upstarts. El Arian says the next 20 or 30 years will be filled with tumult, though he has some good news for the long haul.
We are all on this bumpy journey to a new destination. The new destination is more stable. It is better to have many locomotives of growth in the world.
Meanwhile, El Arian says, don't expect too much from your stocks and your bonds. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
Last night at Detroit's Comerica Park, Detroit Tigers pitcher Armando Galarraga was robbed of a perfect game by an umpire's bad call and by Major League Baseball's wariness of instant replay.
Ground ball, right side, Cabrera will cut it off. Galarraga covers. He's out. No, oh, he's safe. He is safe.
There were two out in the ninth, and umpire Jim Joyce called a Cleveland Indian runner safe at first base, even though the video replay clearly showed he was out and that Galarraga had earned a place in baseball history. Everyone could see it, the fans, the announcers.
Why is he safe? Oh, my goodness, Jim Joyce, no!
In the locker room, both Joyce and Galarraga displayed graciousness uncommon for professional sports or for many professions. The umpire apologized to the pitcher and told reporters, I just missed the call. I missed it. There's nobody that feels worse than I do. I'm so sorry. I don't know what to say. And Galarraga told an interviewer, he really feels bad. Nobody's perfect. I understand. Well, joining us now is someone who knows just how less than perfect Jim Joyce feels today. In the 1985 World Series, first base umpire Don Denkinger made a similar bad call that helped Kansas City win Game 6, and they went on to beat St. Louis in the deciding Game 7 as well. Mr. Denkinger, seeing Jim Joyce's call and recalling your own, what'd you think?
Well, it's just a really terrible, sick feeling you get in the pit of your stomach when you see something like that happen, and it happened to me, and I know the feeling, and I know what Jim was going through, and it's so frustrating, and knowing him and knowing how conscientious he is about everything he does and how he works and how much effort he puts into it, this is going to hurt him a little bit, but I do believe he'll get over it.
Now, nowadays, you go to a ball game, and there is a huge TV screen in the ballpark showing replays of the action that just took place. On television, we saw three different angles of this play within a minute or two after it happened. Why shouldn't a baseball umpire be able to, say, consult an official up in the booth or someone to consider reversing his call?
Well, I think they should be able to do that, and I think they need to expand their replay. And they've stuck to their guns, and they've just, you know, kind of introduced it a little bit for boundary calls, home runs, and balls that clear the line in the outfield, and whether they're fair or foul down the lines. And it's time that they expanded a little farther than that.
Can you ever recall a moment when an umpire got, say, a close play at first base wrong, and after hearing something from someone in the subsequent minute said, okay, I reverse the call?
No, never.
Never, never.
Never.
So here you are. You're an umpire. I guess you want us to be aware that you're out there on the field being a major league umpire, but you don't want this kind of notoriety when you're doing
your
job.
No, you sure don't. The only time that I'm talking to anybody now is with the reporters or announcers in baseball is when something like this happens, and they're looking for an answer that just isn't etched in stone. And as long as the commissioner's there, I guess maybe we won't have instant replay. But this may be a wake-up call, and let's hope that he takes the bull by the horn and changes some of it.
How long did it take you to say you're sorry about the 85 call in the World Series?
I don't know if I ever told anybody I was sorry.
Are you?
I said that I missed the call, and but I was out there doing the very best job I could, and the chips fell where they did, and that was kind of the way it came down. I've been to St. Louis a few times, and I've never apologized to Whitey Herzog. I think he knows that I feel badly about the situation, but I don't think I had to say I'm sorry. I don't think that I was the sole reason they lost the World Series that year.
No, they had.
I don't think as a team they hit much more than 122. if they were hitting 260 or 270, they had a much better chance of winning.
They did contribute to their own loss.
They did
for sure.
Sure, they did.
Well, Don Dankinger, thanks a lot for talking with us and about both 1985, your World Series, and also what happened last night in Detroit. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Retired Major League umpire Don Dankinger on the perfect game that wasn't.
You know the old saying, it takes money to make money? MGM Studios has one of the hottest movie properties going, and they don't have the money to finish it. It's author J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. It will not be coming to a theater near you anytime soon. Reporter Kim Masters joins us now. We touch base with her from time to time on Things Hollywood. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Steve.
So what is stopping The Hobbit from getting done?
The Hobbit is a joint effort between Warner Brothers and MGM. And MGM is a very troubled studio and has been for some time, but it's in crisis now. There are creditors who are owed a great deal of money. They're trying to sell it. And there are no buyers. Things are in a funk in Hollywood. And so The Hobbit is in limbo.
But I want to figure this out because it's not like this studio is, just saying I'd gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. I mean, they've got The Hobbit. This is something that's got a guaranteed built-in audience. You can assume that it's going to make tons of money. Why wouldn't creditors line up to loan money to something like that?
You know, it's not just The Hobbit. They want to sell this property, the studio. And the studio has been just languishing. It has no money. It put out its last movie that it released was Hot Tub Time Machine. Memorable, right? That sticks with you. They'd like to go in a time machine back to the days when they were really vibrant and alive, but They're not. They have nothing. They had Guillermo del Toro lined up, this wonderful director who did Pan's Labyrinth and seemed like a great guy. He had, of course, Peter Jackson. Jackson, who did the Lord of the Rings trilogy. He was blessed by Peter Jackson to do two Hobbit movies, actually. And then he had to back out. Why? Because it's in limbo. And if they go forward now and there is no buyer and all of these creditors that are owed money and are controlling the fate of MGM decide to go into bankruptcy, then a company like Time Warner that invested in the Hobbit could find that it is completely out of luck and that it had lost its investment while this company is stuck in bankruptcy. So it's held the Hobbit up indefinitely.
And also the latest 007 movie.
That's exactly right. What would seem to be one of the surest things in the movie business, Bond, you know, James Bond, that would have been Bond 23. Talk about a franchise. But again, the Broccoli family, which controls Bond, they don't want to go forward with the Bond movie and then find that there's a bankruptcy and this thing is bollocked up in a bankruptcy for an indefinite period. So all of this stuff is now on hold. And it's a symptom of what's wrong with Hollywood.
I think you've just answered the question for me of why, even though these movies seem to be guaranteed moneymakers, that they might not go forward because the possibility of a bankruptcy raises big questions about who would ever get the profits from that.
There's that, and there's the, and then there's another issue relating to this MGM sale, which is it owns this library. Libraries have plummeted in value. DVDs are not selling. There's all of this uncertainty about how you're going to watch movies and who's going to pay for it. You know, you're going to watch it in your house. Are you going to, is it going to be streamed? Are you going to get it for a dollar out of Redbox? So the library value is questionable, and that holds up the MGM sale, and therefore everything is on hold.
When Hollywood can't even get The Hobbit and a James Bond movie out the door, does that make the whole industry well beyond MGM a little depressed?
Well, it's not just that. We just had one of the worst at the Memorial Day weekend, which had a number of big, supposedly big movies, you know, Prince of Persia and the godforsaken Sex and the City sequel. This was one of the worst box office weekends on Memorial Day, I think, since 1993. So there is anxiety, of course, in Hollywood right now. And there's just a feeling that the future is a big question mark.
Kim, always good to talk with you.
Thank you, Steve.
Kim Masters hosts The Business on member station KCRW and is editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter.